Welcome to episode 127 for Thursday the 28th of November, Flipping Socrates. Good evening, Bill. It's wonderful to talk to you again.
Hi, Steve. Hi. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. Yeah, I've had an interesting week. Done some interesting teaching with some international students in Manchester from all over the world, actually. I learned a little bit about Kazakhstan and Chile and places. So, no, I've learned a lot this week. How about yourself?
Yeah, I've struggling to say what I've been doing a little bit of writing, actually. Stuck a blog post up again, which always looks effortless when it appears, but it takes a bit of blood, sweat and tears in the making.
Yeah,
I do little bits and pieces of writing. I've done a little bit of in-service training in a primary school over in Renfrewshire on digital literacy, which is good.
Yeah.
Lovely school, great.
Excellent. Actually, just while you come to mention it, do you find the digital writing, the blog writing, a different? I mean, do you have to? Is it a different discipline for you?
Yeah, I think yes is the simple answer. It is a different discipline. I used to write fairly regularly for, say, the test, for example. And at that time, I mean, going back 10 years or so, at that time, it was about, I think, 1,000 words was the standard. So it was obviously lengthier. The average blog post, I guess, is maybe 500-600 words, I would think. And, of course, the blog, or my blog, involves uploading photographs and video clips and so on as well. So there are issues about, it's a bit more like a newsletter, I suppose. There are issues of layout and style and stuff which you want to think about. You don't always get it right, of course, but yeah, so it is different. Yeah, it is different.
I'm just wondering, I mean, I don't know, I mean, I haven't a clue, but I was just wondering if there was a kind of optimum length of blogs, you know, after which people in these sort of very quick Twitter days sort of switch off quickly, or I mean, how long have you got to get the key message across?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. I mean, you don't know really. I would guess it's somewhere around 500 or 600 words, but it depends what the words are, of course. Maybe it's thoroughly boring. They're going to switch off after the first two lines. There's always a temptation with a blog, I think, at least with me. There's always a temptation to go into bullet points or lists, and sometimes I do that, but I try to avoid that in the main.
Yeah. I mean, a colleague of mine, a Manchester professor, Helen Gunter, who we have had on the podcast before, wrote a wonderful paper about the tyranny of bullet points. She tore into policy making that was done in bullet points and the shortcomings of a bullet point.
There's nothing worse than ploughing through a document that is just page after page of bullet points.
And you're having
to join up the words for yourself then, aren't you, really?
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, this preamble is by way of, as listeners might have noticed, the wonderful smooth tones of Matthew are absent tonight. We're giving Matthew a break. And Bill and I are taking on the cast. We were hoped to be joined by Jay, but he's obviously having trouble finding the substitute shirt, and we haven't been able to pick him up yet. It's still warming the bench, so if Jay can manage to drop in, we'll bring him in later on in the conversation. Talking of the kind of not knowing, I mean, we don't know on this podcast exactly how long people listen to it. I know it sends one of our regular listeners off to sleep, so that's always a good service to provide, I suppose. But
absolutely, cheaper than drink.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'd probably get about, I don't know, 2,000 episodes downloaded. So, you know, there's a big void out there. So listeners, you know, if you have got something or you want to join in the conversation, please do get in contact with us. We'd love to hear from you. So, Bill, we're going to chat through some of the things that have caught your eye this week, and I know there's a big story. We're all waited in policy circles with bated breath because there's about to be a publication, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. It was brought to my attention again through Twitter this week, where else?
Yeah.
And it was a link to an article in The Guardian by a fellow called Peter Wilby. And it's about the, as you say, the awaited arrival of the PISA results from the OECD PISA studies for 15-year-olds. Which are due out on Tuesday, I believe, 3rd of December.
Yeah.
The article's about it's about the PISA tests themselves. It's about the processes. It's about what they attempt to measure and so on. It's about the huge impact that they have across the world. I think it's 60-odd countries across the world which take part in the PISA trials. But it's also interestingly about the guy who came up with the PISA tests, the inventor, if you like, if that's the right word, a fella called Andreas Schleicher.
Oh, yeah, Matthew loves that. He loves. He'd have loved to have been on the program. He just loves to roll his tongue around Schleicher.
Around the name.
Yes.
Yes, Andreas Schleicher, who's a very interesting character in himself. The article describes him as a pacifist. He says we should construct the world, not destroy it. Who, against his parents' strong opposition, refused military service and opted instead for social service, teaching handicapped children. That was his only experience of teaching, but much of his passion for improving schools is influenced by his own experiences, which were not particularly positive. His father, interestingly, was a professor of education, and his mother was a doctor. His first job was in the medical industry, researching the applications of nuclear magnetic resonance. But he moved into the area of educational research and statistics, and he's a great man for data, as you would imagine, of course. Great believer in data. His catchphrase, apparently, displayed in a continuously rolling ticker as he ends his lectures, is "Without data, you are just another person with an opinion." To which somebody in the comment section of The Guardian replied, "With data, you are just another person with a spreadsheet." So I guess their view of the PISA statistics was a bit more cynical. But the PISA PISA results themselves, as I said, have massive influence on politicians around the world. I mean, it cites here that roughly half the countries that have taken PISA tests since they started in the year 2000 have reformed their education systems in light of the results. For example, Germany's poor performance in the first tests came as a real shock to the country. And all but one state introduced an academic school leaving exam as a result of it. And many of them abandoned the traditional German school half day. The United States, for example, embarked on a nationwide development of the Common Core standards, which most people will have heard of, at least if they're not really familiar with them. But that was a result of poor performance, apparently poor performance in the PISA tests. And even Japan, which was usually a high performer, went into some sort of crisis when it slipped down the league tables in 2009.
Mm. Yes, so huge influence. I know, I mean, our politicians are always looking to them in terms of transfer, or they feed into a Daily Mail headline.
British
are the worst in the world, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, there is that, of course. I mean, Andreas Schleicher himself, he was asked about the UK, specifically England, and about our dear friend Mr. Gove. And he was a bit coy. He didn't particularly want to comment on Gove necessarily, but what he did say was that he did praise the English system for giving schools greater levels of responsibility, or the current, if you like, the current government for giving schools greater levels of responsibility. But he also said that he criticised the fact that they had gone in the direction of making the curriculum more focused on facts and figures, which is interesting in itself, because you may have thought that somebody who was responsible for the world's biggest tests and was a big fan of statistics would have been quite keen on facts and figures. But in actual fact, Schleicher and his wife live in Paris, and their children go to school, obviously, in France. And he's very critical of the French education system. He says it's one of the most backward school systems in the world. Really? And it's very much based on rote learning. So he isn't a fan of, in inverted commas, traditional modes of learning necessarily. In fact, he does say that, Peter Wilby, the writer of the article, says that he's actually a bit trendy, that is the word he uses, at least in his views on curriculum and teaching styles, if not on school governance. So he's an interesting
character.
Complex character, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I know it's interesting, because I know when they first started to generate some traction, the PISA results, I know New Labour were kind of criticised at one point because they hadn't entered the data properly. But they then later used that in their defence, saying, oh, well, when they showed their performance wasn't so good, he said, well, we haven't completed the data set very well. But they've recently revised the tests, haven't they, they've used. I mean, and there's a lot of dispute about the credibility of the stats.
There is a lot of criticism of the tests and of the stats, understandably. I mean, for example, critics say that it's comparing apples with oranges, really, that you can't compare what children of 15 in Poland are doing by comparison with what people in age 15 in Japan are doing and whatever. And in actual fact, in a sense, it's worse than that, because apparently, I didn't realise until I read this article, but apparently the children don't all actually sit the same test or have the same test items. For example, in the reading trial, only 10% of those who took part in PISA 2006 were tested on all 28 reading questions, and about half weren't tested on reading at all. What happens, apparently, is the OECD feeds the real scores into a statistical device called the RASH model, so that it can work out plausible values for children who weren't tested. Schleicher says, we want to test lots of different things, but we have limited time, so we give the students different tests with overlapping content. He says it's a long-established statistical technique enhanced by modern technology. But, of course, other statisticians say that this can't work.
Because it brings them out in spots.
You're measuring different things with different people. Yeah. Apparently, according to critics, in 2006, they say the UK could have finished anywhere between 14th and 30th on the reading test.
Yeah.
And apparently, Japan could have finished anywhere between 8th and 40th.
Well, that's just...
No, that's just nonsense. If that's the case, then it's pointless.
Yeah, it is meaningless. I mean, I know one year Shanghai came out top, didn't it, in a number of measures. But, you know, some people, policy critics, are saying, well, Shanghai has the highest amount of home tutoring for 15-year-olds. So all these 15-year-olds are getting hothoused by private tutors from the growing kind of wealth in Shanghai.
Well, as I said, apparently he has criticised, especially the French system, for example, for its emphasis on rote learning. But, of course, I would have thought that if you're going to prepare kids for these kinds of tests, that there would be a great deal of rote learning and intensive battery farming involved.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting sociologically is the rise of these huge data sets that we have now to kind of govern education policy. I mean, partly because I suppose we can do it, therefore we do it. You know, we have the computing capacity to compile these stats, but it says something, doesn't it? I don't know. It says something to me about the nature of audit, you know, the role of audit in our society, particularly when you have a kind of a neoliberal trend to more and more marketize education.
And
markets depend on people supposedly making rational choices, which we know to be a kind of a misnomer. Yeah. And therefore, in order to make a rational choice, you have to present them with data, so the argument goes.
Interestingly, I mean, the tests are in reading, maths, and science, and of course, my main interest was in reading. Yeah. And the tests are carried out on behalf of the OECD in this country by NFER, National Foundation for Educational Research. So I went to their website to see if I could get some information about the Scottish reading results in 2009. And I could find a report on reading 2009 on England, Wales and Northern Ireland, but not on Scotland, interestingly enough. Although I'm sure it does exist, I just couldn't find it. But so I had a look at the English one, and there were one or two sort of interesting things came out of it, because the tests don't only test ability, but there's also a sort of questionnaire element of it, which asks kids about their attitudes to various things, and you'll see these reported in the press, particularly tabloid press at times. You know, kids hate this, and you spend all the time doing that, whatever. But one or two interesting points. I mean, there are no significant differences, if you like, in reading ability across the countries of the UK. It says attitudes to reading had a positive connection with reading scores. No great surprises there. You know, kids who like reading or have a positive attitude to it are better readers. So not exactly mind-blowing stuff there. But there's an interesting comment on reading attitudes themselves. The results from the pupil questionnaire tend to paint a negative picture of many pupils' reading activities in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. No mention of Scotland. I don't know whether that means it's different or better. Many are not interested in reading, partake in few reading activities for pleasure, and rarely visit a library. So, it does lead to some very significant conclusions, I suppose.
Yes, and as you said, it's obviously has profound, more and more profound effects each year it's published. In terms of,
I think what seems to me often happens, Steve, is that it comes out with certain conclusions which are probably quite plausible, but then politicians take these conclusions and implement entirely the wrong policies to try to bring about a change.
I mean, I know one example of that is, again, New Labour, there was some fairly bleak looking statistics about English teenagers and their behaviour in one of these reports, you know, this is kind of around the time that Tony Blair was coming out with these mad things like, you know, marching a hoodie down to the cash point and all that surveillance stuff.
More discipline.
Yes, that's right. But one of the, you know, and the Finns were doing really well in these stats, but actually they had I think they had one of the lowest numbers of teenagers who actually sat down with their parents for a meal. So you get all these politicians saying, oh, nobody sits around a family, you know, around the table, have a family meal, and it's all bad parenting, and, you know, why aren't you like us middle-class parents? And actually the Finnish teenagers had a very low score for sitting around the family table having a meal, and yet there they were at the top of the...
The other thing that strikes me is when you look at the countries that tend to come out on the top of the PISA rankings, if you like, I think they're in a funny kind of way. They're at both extremes. They're either very liberal in their approach to schools and education. You know, they start later. They're less disciplined in the general sense of the word. They don't wear uniforms, all that stuff. Or they're in massive classes in rows, serried ranks, and they don't get to speak. And I think probably the best kind of formal education might be somewhere in between these two extremes.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's presumably when the actual results come out, there'll be more food for the podcast next week.
I'm sure.
Yeah, so no, that's a really interesting story, a very significant one, I think, in terms of current policy. So I'm going to refrain from making any Pisa jokes, and I'll top that puns. I know Matthew probably would have less discipline than me.
Well, the title in the Guardian article is the OECD's Pisa delivery man, of course.
Yes, of course, yeah. So anyway, topping that news item, I'll just reading. I love to read Private Eye. I just, you know, particularly if I'm on a train, and you think if half the stuff they printed there is true, then you think, God, what a corrupt country we are. But this one is about, it caught my eye, was they did the column called Rotten Boroughs. They kind of exposed the hypocrisy that goes on some of our local government. And this one was about Fulham, a free school that's been proposed in Fulham. And it relates to other news items that I caught, so I'll just bring it together briefly. But there was a plan to relocate and merge a very successful primary school in the Fulham area with a smaller school that had been struggling financially. And then once the site was free, it would be used for a new Fulham boys free school. But the teachers and the pupils and the parents heard was when a kind of a cabinet member for education told the head teacher they wanted to close the school, you know, and the document had already gone, you know, the public consultation had already gone to the printers. So, you know, the school hadn't been given an opportunity. Nobody in the school had been given an opportunity to consult on it. And, you know, one of the free school partners, the Church of England Diocesan Board, was sort of, they said, well, you know, who were going to be one of the partners in the new free school taking over the site, said it was neither moral, you know, this decision was neither moral nor right. They could kind of go on to sort of say how the councillor really couldn't give a articulate or persuasive view as to why there should be a free school on this site anyway. And it just came in because I, on the local news the other night, was Ofsted had given Nottinghamshire a real damning report in terms of the standards of its schools. And there's another one I saw today about Northumberland blasted by Ofsted. And what I'm drawing together in these news stories is that there's a huge political pressure, I think, on this drive for free schools and academies. So, you know, essentially, Ofsted have upped the standards in inspection in schools. They've changed them. You know, the goalposts are changing. So, requires improvement. Used to be satisfactory. Has now become a damning. You know, satisfactory was, well, you think it's satisfactory, it's good enough. You can always do better. Of course, you can.
The whole free school thing obviously is something that's quite alien to us up here. From what you're saying, is it a case of central government is coming in over the heads of local authority and making a decision and saying you're closing or you're opening a free school here?
It seems to be. I think there's a drive. I think the levers. I think Ofsted has become much more political in its orientation. And that free school story kind of seems to suggest also that the views of parents and a successful school staff don't seem to matter in the, you know, because a Tory councillor, and the same with these authorities, you know, that I think what I read from this is the underlying lever is, we want to kind of drive this academy program forward. We want to cut the kind of, and actually, there's no kind of democracy in it because it's being driven by central government, and they're not really
Ofsted are not as removed from the government as they should be. Is that the
well? That's my That's my reading of it. I mean, that, you know, and again, Ofsted would obviously deny that. And other
opinion, people, of course.
Yes, brackets. My opinion, yes. Other, you know, people would deny that. But I think there's been a number of cases around the country, particularly in London, where parental views, for example, have been ignored and trampled on. Mm. And the direction has come from the centre, saying, no, you're not good enough. We're going to kind of put a sponsor in or whatever, and you've got to become an academy. So I just think that the notion of, you know, local, again, coming back to this notion of localism, I think it's just been a bit of a nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously driven by the ideology of free speech. I mean, presumably the current government is not keen on the idea of sort of local authority control over things, I guess.
No.
I mean, I don't. I follow any number of teachers and educationists in England, and I'm well aware via Twitter of this sort of unease, if you like, over Ofsted and the role that they're playing in various. I see a lot of criticism of Ofsted on Twitter, but I suppose maybe from teachers you would expect that. I don't know.
Yes, but I mean, I was talking to some students recently who, you know, in a school where their teaching had been judged good or outstanding, you know, and the majority of the lessons are good in this department. You know, not they had an Ofsted inspection and they were all judged to be requiring improvement. Mm. You know, so how can they consistently, they're saying, well, how can we be consistently, you know, we're working our, what's it's off here? You know, we can't work any harder than we are. And you know, we've been consistently good. So how come suddenly our performance is unacceptable?
Yeah.
And the thing these teachers, young teachers are saying, well, you know, the heads of department who have come in and the senior management who are coming in to do the kind of clipboard bit and try and drive their performance up in between these inspections, they're getting rated as requiring improvement as well. Mm. So the heads of department can't even cut through. So what they're saying is the goalposts are changing all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I've been... We've got, obviously, our inspectorate as well here. And I've been one of its biggest critics. Not that I think they necessarily do a disastrously bad job. I just wonder about their role, generally about whether if you remove them tomorrow, whether things would significantly worsen, or whether they would improve, or whether nobody would notice any difference whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have my own views on that. I mean, obviously, teachers in schools have to be accountable, but in my opinion, the people that they should be most accountable to are their local communities, their local kids and parents and communities. So in a funny kind of way, that almost puts me, I guess, into the free school camp, because I guess one of the, I imagine, to be fair to Gove and the rest of them, I imagine one of the principles behind the idea of free schools is that schools are more accountable to their local community. Maybe it just doesn't work out that way in reality.
No,
maybe the conditions are not right or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in theory, yes, and that principle is, as you say, there's a lot to be kind of explored in that principle. I just say that I just kind of feel, I suppose I feel really sorry for a generation of teachers who have probably been driven into the ground. I mean, I don't know how much harder some of them can work, you know, in these circumstances when they're being blamed for all the kind of social ills.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right, Steve. I think, I don't know who it was, it said something like, there's good hard work and there's bad hard work. Yeah. And I think teachers, I mean, having been a teacher myself for 30 years, you don't mind hard work if it's good hard work. You know, if you think it's productive and it's benefiting the kids and so on. But if it's bad hard work, as in it's only to keep somebody off your back or tick the right boxes or whatever, that is very draining.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so I know it's not the first time I've raised it, but it seems to be coming to a head more and more in more and more cases, and I should be interested to see whether certain authorities are going to be, you know, they may even be taken over in some ways by the department. I think that was a threat to Birmingham Children's Services recently, because they were failing in terms of the social care aspect. So it's almost a kind of Stalinist...
Well, that in itself raises a whole lot of questions. How can central government run all these schools?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's just doesn't bear thinking about.
No, it doesn't. Anyway, I believe that Bill, you've been writing about that Socrates has been a bit of a pain. You've been flipping around on your blog.
Yeah, that old Socrates.
He was a guy, wasn't he?
Well, they saw fit to get rid of
him. Imagine walking down? Because ancient Athens couldn't have been a very big place, could it? And imagine walking down the street and think, "Oh God, there's Socrates! I'm going to have to."
Everybody would have known him.
Yes.
Well, he was a great, an original corrupter of youth, wasn't he? So I read a book about using Socratic circles in the classroom some time ago by an American guy called Matt Copeland, and I found it really, really interesting. I was reading it sort of in the context of developing higher order questioning skills, if you like, and how to do that. And I read it, I found it interesting, and I kind of put it aside. And then I was reading recently quite a number of articles and pieces about flipped learning and the flipped classroom, which I'm sure you will have heard something about. And the Salman Khan and the Khan Academy. This is a guy who started preparing little video lessons for his cousin, and then started to put them on YouTube for her friends and various other people. And the idea caught on that these kids were doing their revision and maths prep and stuff from these videos. And within a couple of years, there were millions of hits on the videos. And this guy Khan gave up his day job, if you like, to start Khan Academy. And it's now a massive online learning space, if you like. And so I've noticed quite a number of debates and discussions on teachers' blogs and so on about the flipped classroom, and some people who have apparently flipped the classroom, and other people saying that it's flipping nonsense to suggest that you should flip your classroom. The basic idea is that is it the sort of direct instruction part, if you like, that the teacher may have been doing in class is done online, is done out of class.
In their own time?
In their own time, yeah. So the kids can learn, if they're learning a particular topic in science or maths or whatever, calculus, they just go to the appropriate video clip. The advantage is that, they can stop the video, they can replay bits of the video, they can watch it as many times as they want until they learn the particular bit, and they can go at their own pace. But a lot of the discussion, the use of this seemed to me to be at sort of college and university level rather than school level. So the question for me was whether this sort of approach could be equally successful in a school, or were kids too young, or was it a different environment? Was it not appropriate? And I've been trying to find any teacher in Scotland who's flipped their classroom or whatever, but I can't find any.
So there's a challenge for listeners, please.
At least none who are willing to come forward and tell me about it.
Yeah.
But I just wondered, at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, whether kids are still being taught thinking skills, critical thinking. Yeah. So maybe it's not appropriate. Maybe it's not appropriate methodology. But in looking at the Khan Academy and the idea of the flipped classroom, the notion of Socratic circles came back to me, because there's a bit of an overlap there, because the principle of Socratic circles is that the kids engage with a text out of school, so in a sense it's homework, a short text, and it doesn't have to be a printed text, it could be a video clip or any kind of text really. What they do is they engage with the text, that is, they look at it or read it critically, they take some notes around it, they take a note of what they think their understanding of the text is, the bits they don't understand, the questions that arise that puzzle them. So when they come into class, the procedure is that two circles are formed in the classroom. The teacher's role really is simply to structure the whole thing and make sure it goes and, you know, it stays on track, if you like. And the inner circle discuss the text. Those people in the outer circle are not allowed to speak during this time. Now, the time can be a minute, it can be 10 minutes, it can be half an hour, it doesn't really matter. But at the end of the time, the people in the outer circle comment on the discussion. And then they swap places, so the outer circle becomes the inner circle, and vice versa. Then so the people who are now in the inner circle carry on the discussion from where it left off. So effectively, what's going on there is it's a learning process. Every child is expected to make at least one contribution in the course of the discussion. But the interesting thing about it for me is that it's not competitive. It's not a debate. So there are no winners and losers. But the theory is that everybody, by the end of the discussion, everybody has a better understanding of the text, whatever the text may be. Mm. Now, presumably, the text could also be, for example, that very same maths topic or whatever, which I guess they could watch a clip from the Khan Academy.
Yeah.
Theoretically.
That's interesting. So are they, before they kind of given the text or whatever, or the material, I mean, is there any training in kind of how to critically approach that? I mean, do you do some input on what a critical analysis would look like?
That's a good question, yeah. I mean, I guess that's dependent on the age and stage the ability of the kids and so on, as to what the teacher input would be. But I would guess the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Steve.
Yeah.
What form that? I mean, it could take many forms, of course. Yeah. The teacher could be modelling that sort of questioning technique, if you like.
Mm. I remember many years ago I did a series of courses on philosophy for children, you know, particularly using picture books with young primary children, which was really interested, based on a sort of Socratic dialogue, again in a circle. And you presented like a sort of a picture book, you know. It could be anything. It's a really, really engaging picture books, like Where the Wild Things Are, or the one about the elephants. I can't remember the title now. but then you get the children to sort of generate questions, you know, to listen to the book, and then they generate, and you write them all down on a flip chart. I mean, this is essentially the method.
Mm.
And then choose a kind of question. They kind of vote on a question that they'd like to discuss and start them off. But I mean, the discussion could go anywhere. I mean, there's no compulsion on any of the children to contribute. There's different ways that, you know, different sort of little techniques you can have for passing the baton, for allowing people to speak. I mean, what was interesting about that process, once you develop, is how easily the kind of even very young children got into the listening and the dialogue bit. I mean, the question you always kind of wonder about the children who were very, very quiet. But I mean, there are kind of, you know, people have done research on it, and you know, and some of those very, very quiet children will will kind of remember something really, really important at a later mm-hmm. date. Mm-hmm. But the notion is of interrogating the question and using the question as a stimulus from the story. I mean, I remember one kind of session I did with, I think there were kind of 6-7 year olds, I can't remember. And we had a load of questions. Some of them were very, very literal questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, well, which one's a philosophical question? You know, and a number of children put their hands up, and they all said, you know, well, those two are philosophical. They kind of intuitively knew which were mm-hmm. more philosophical questions than the literal ones, or which were the interesting ones. You know, I found it a fascinating process. I think one of the issues is how far that generalizes into other thinking skills. I mean, I think that's one of the critical issues mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. the research is a bit kind of maybe weak on or hasn't followed, you know.
Yeah. And how you make sure that's progressive, how these skills continue yes. to develop, and they don't just kind of stay around at the same level sort of thing. But one of the examples I use when I'm talking to teachers is I use example of a simple poem, say something appropriate for a sort of upper primary level. What I do with the teachers is we read the poem together, and I say, right, okay, I want you to find patterns there for me, and so they work away for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, and they come up with a whole load of things, and then we discuss what has come up, and of course you get everything from patterns about language patterns, about patterns of punctuation, patterns of imagery, rhyme schemes, etc., etc. And then I said to him, well, actually, if I had been in inverted commas teaching that poem 20 years ago, what I would most likely have done is I would give it out to the class, we'd read it together, and I would probably say issue them with 10 questions, you know, on a sheet or on the board or whatever. And if it was being very progressive-minded, I would say, discuss them in groups, and then we'll talk about them. But if I was doing it now, I wouldn't actually issue the questions at all. I would just say, here's a poem, read it together, find the patterns. And what happens then is, they come up with the questions. And the questions they come up with, invariably, are the same questions, are very similar to the questions that you would have given them in the first place.
Right.
But the difference is because they've generated the questions, of course, they're much more interested in the answers.
Yes. Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. So you think there's something in the Socratic circles and the flipped classroom that's worth pursuing pedagogically? You think there's a...
I think there is definitely something that's worth pursuing. I think the problem, as with all of these things, Steve, is that if you go wholesale for that kind of methodology, you know, you throw the baby out with the bathwater or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Other cliche we happen to come up with.
But
again, the answer's probably... what I like about Socratic circles is if you have any kind of notion to flip your classroom, or to put that in another way, if you are the kind of teacher who thinks that you would like to hand more of the responsibility for learning to the learners rather than carrying it all by yourself, as can be the case in some instances, I think introducing Socratic circles is quite a manageable way to do it.
Yeah.
And you don't need to do it all the time, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me that these are the kind of, as you said, it's not a... It's when you judge the intervention to be appropriate, don't you? And that seems to me an example of the wisdom of being a teacher, mm-hmm. which the kind of that tick box and standards based approach that we've gotten into, you know, where you kind of script your teaching, or you're going to judge teachers by these kind of list of technical attributes that we happen to have come up with and put in a bullet point.
Well, absolutely, and ironically, of course, I think on the face of it, the kind of approach that the Socratic circles requires suggests a lesser role for the teacher because the teacher does less of the talking, if you like. But in actual fact, it actually gives the teacher a much more professional role. Mm. Rather than simple, if we go back to discussions from the previous podcasts, that you the deliverology model of education, where you just deliver the lesson.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and you know counterintuitively, the sort of the philosophy for children work we did was actually quite hard work. You know, you've been intensely listening. You're trying to model that intense listening. You're trying to probe and prompt and draw out, you know. It's actually in some ways a lot harder than standing up and talking for 10 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, you as a teacher, you're having to think on your feet as well, because you don't know what direction it's going to go in.
Absolutely.
At any particular time.
No.
The other thing that appeals to me about it, Steve, is that one of the central shifts in the Scottish curriculum, in Curriculum for Excellence, is the emphasis on the learner. The I can statements. I can. Now, that's a massive shift on paper, but in actual fact, to make that shift in the classroom, rather than just on a sort of paper theory, is very challenging. But I think this is one of the ways in which that can be done.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting, Bill, and we'll put the link up to your blog because you've got an interesting page there. But I'm very well aware of the time because we went on and on and on, didn't we, last time
we
spoke together?
We did.
We're going to say short and snappy tonight.
I'm
going to draw a line under it there. And it's been hugely enjoyable talking to you again. Very interesting. Mm. So thank you for your participation.
Enjoyed it myself, I did.
And you're coming back again soon. Are you coming back next week? I know Matthew's going to be here next week. I'm taking a break.
I think Matthew's got a guest. I'm not sure when I'll be back.
So you'll be
but I will be back.
Back soon. That's good.
Heard that before somewhere.
So, thanks ever so much, Bill. Enjoyed the conversation, and good night.
Pleasure, Steve. Pleasure. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.